I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today, I'm talking to Andrew Huddleston, reader in philosophy at Birkbeck University of London, about his 2019 book, Nietzsche on the Decadence and Flourishing of Culture, from Oxford University Press. Huddleston works on late modern continental philosophy, including German idealism, early German Romanticism, Nietzsche, and the Frankfurt School, and has written many articles on topics as diverse as nihilism, art, and religion. So, first of all, Andrew Huddleston, thank you for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Thank you very much for having me.
Andrew, I love the book. It was a very enjoyable book, very carefully argued book about Nietzsche's view of culture, which is most prominent, of course, in Nietzsche's early period, but you argue really continues into his mature work and indeed pervades his entire corpus. So as a fan of Nietzsche myself, I enjoyed the book, so thank you for writing it.
Thanks for saying so.
Let me start, as I always do, with maybe you could say a little bit about what motivated you to write the book.
Well, one motivation was a concern that Nietzsche's individualism had gotten too much attention in Anglophone philosophical scholarship. The idea that he's concerned just with the promotion of a few excellent individuals and is not concerned with any sort of broader culture. And I thought that that was a mistake, that though there is a strong strand of individualism in Nietzsche's work, this is a misleading picture of his ongoing concerns, and certainly a misleading picture of his position in the early work. So I wanted a kind of corrective against that overemphasis on the individualism in Nietzsche's work. I also wanted to try to connect Nietzsche to a broader tradition of, a range of different figures in the philosophical tradition that I think he hasn't been associated with quite as much. So, of course, there's been lots done on Nietzsche's connection with Schopenhauer, lots done on Nietzsche's connection with a variety of other figures, but I think less done on Nietzsche's connection with the German Romantics, for example. And I wanted to bring out what I saw some of the important commonalities between Nietzsche and the early German Romantics, even though at some of the points where he discusses them explicitly, he's quite dismissive. But I think that he takes a number of the ideas on board and that they have an important influence on his thinking about the philosophy of culture. And I think the philosophy of culture in this period, as you argue in your book as well, is very, very developed and rich in a variety of figures, not just in the Romantics, but in Herder and in Kant and in lots of others. And I think Nietzsche's a participant in that conversation, and I wanted to try to bring out the ways in which his contributions are a continuation of that conversation, but also challenging it in various ways.
Yeah, good. So let's dig in a little bit into where you began with the sort of target, scholarly target of the book, because I completely agree with you that there has been too much of an emphasis on the great individual, in Nietzsche's cultural and political theory, and you argue that instead we should emphasize also the communal. I think Julian Young started the communitarian reading of Nietzsche. Now, you don't go so far as Julian Young, who sort of says that community is everything in Nietzsche. This is simplification. Mm-hmm. Community is everything in Nietzsche, and the individual is nothing, but sort of want to moderate, mediate between those two positions. So maybe we could just start out a little bit by just sketching sort of who you're arguing against, what the kind of common approach and understanding Nietzsche's ethics that's based on the idea of the great individual.
Yeah, well, I guess I see myself as trying to stake out a kind of middle ground between the Julian Young position you mentioned, a more communitarian sort of Nietzsche on the one hand, and then the sort of individualist readings that I was mentioning at the start on the other hand. So individualist readings represented by a range of different people, but for instance, Alexander Nehemos has a version of it, Brian Leiter has a version of it. Detweiler has a version of it. I mean, you see a lot of different people with some version of individualism. And I think Jung is a kind of corrective against that, thinking that Nietzsche's interested in the promotion of communities and the flourishing of communities, and wants to present a reading of Nietzsche where that is front and center. But I'm skeptical, I think, about both of these extremes. And one of the reasons I prefer the terminology of culture over community is that I think it has different kinds of connotations to it. Community, as Jung understands it, is something that is united by a shared body of myth and a kind of common worldview. And I think that's something that Nietzsche is not very optimistic about by the time we get to the later work. In his early work, he is more optimistic about that and thinks this Wagnerian program of bringing together a fragmented society and uniting German culture in particular through a kind of reinvigoration of myth, that something like that would be possible. And I think he continues to think something like that is possible when he starts off with the project of writing Thus Spoke Zarathustra, where he's trying to do it himself, as it were, trying to give us this new mythology to bring culture together. But I think he becomes doubtful that something like that is actually going to be possible, that there will be something that will unite a whole community together, but nonetheless thinks that collective entities, if you will, are valuable in their own right, not just a few great individuals, but social totalities too. So that's why I try to play up the culture strand and to differentiate it from the more communal or communitarian strand as it's developed in the Julian Jung interpretation.
So let's start then with the notion of culture that you use, which I think rightly use the term culture, the German is Kultur, in contrast to the notion of community, which Nietzsche tends not to use in my memory. So what does Nietzsche mean by culture? You identify as a kind of several different conceptions or roles that culture plays in his thought. Maybe you could just start by sketching overall how Nietzsche conceives of culture.
Yeah, I think there are a few different ideas in play that he's picking up on from both different strands in the philosophical tradition and also just from our kind of colloquial way of thinking about what a culture is that he shared and was shared at the time. And perhaps that most obvious colloquial way of thinking about it is just culture as a body of practices and ideas that give people a direction and orientation in life. Where that includes, but is not limited to, artworks. It also includes various kinds of rituals and other sorts of practices. And I think that that's one of the central ideas of culture that he's operating with in his work. But it's not one of the ones that's particularly distinctive to him. I think the one that's really distinctive to Nietzsche is the idea that culture understood in that way, if seen from a certain perspective, can embody a kind of excellence in its whole way of life, so that it's, if you will, kind of a different angle or perspective on the culture, looking at it as a kind of work of art, which is an image that he will use in a number of different places, that the culture, the way of life embodied in the culture is akin to a work of art in the way that it realizes certain kinds of human excellence. And I think that idea is one that we see anticipated in the early work, where he has the idea of a number of thoughts that are closely connecting art and culture and aesthetic justification and these notions that are in play in The Birth of Tragedy. And I think we see that idea get worked over in various ways. And then all the way through to the late work, I think we have the idea that culture is understood as these kinds of social totalities are able to realize a kind of collective excellence in their whole way of life, a way of excellence that expresses nobility and strength and what have you, these Nietzschean ideals, but not just at the individual level, at the level of the whole culture too.
Yeah, that's good. Let's start with The Birth of Tragedy, because that's where you start in the book as well. How does Nietzsche's account of culture fit in with what you were just saying there in The Birth of Tragedy? I ask that because, as you bring out well in the book, one of the features of culture, one of the functions of culture in The Birth of Tragedy, is to serve in some kind of role of existential solace in the face of, you know, some kind of, like, Silenus's truth that it's better not to be born, you know, it's best not to be born, second best to die soon. How does that account of culture that he develops in The Birth of Tragedy, or maybe you can say a little bit more about that, and then how that relates to the view of culture as a form of art?
Yeah. So, well, I think one important, or a number of important ideas in Nietzsche and around culture center on what its value derives from. Whether its value derives from providing us with something such as existential solace, which you've just mentioned, or whether it's something that's, as it were, valuable in itself, independently of some further thing that it provides us for. So it's a question about whether it's, if you will want to use these terms, instrumentally valuable as opposed to valuable for its own sake or as an end in itself. And I think in The Birth of Tragedy, Nietzsche's primarily thinking of it in these more functional terms or instrumental terms, is something that's valuable insofar as it serves to provide existential solace. So he's interpreting culture as having a crucial function, and thinks that the sort of culture that we have in the kind of fragmented Europe of the time is not able to provide that kind of existential function well. The religious narratives that were in circulation and that had a kind of social hold before have evaporated, at least when it comes to providing a kind of meaning to a large group of people. And we need something else that's going to do that. And I think he thinks that this reinvigoration of myth is going to be a route to providing that kind of existential solace. It will be in that way taking over the function of religion, doing the same kind of thing that religion did. And I think we see a lot of the vocabulary of religion in the way that Nietzsche talks about culture and art in The Birth of Tragedy in a way that's surprising, coming from someone who's an atheist, talking about it in terms of aesthetic justification, or talking about using the terminology of theodicy in The Birth of Tragedy. And I think he's seeing a certain kind of commonality or continuity between what art can do and what religion previously did. And of course, tracing this back to the Greek Tragic Festival, which is a combination of those two things, a religious festival and an artistic endeavor as well.
Yeah, and of course, in The Birth of Tragedy, there is the figure of the genius, and there are sort of quasi-great individuals in that text as well. I mean, it's dedicated to Wagner, but also in the discussion of Greek myth, there's discussion of Oedipus and Prometheus, and then in the later part of the text, of course, Wagner makes a return. So I guess this, you know, a similar question is raised here when thinking about that core notion of the aesthetic justification of existence, which is really at the center of Nietzsche's project there in the in The Birth of Tragedy, is how is the notion of culture and these individuals related to one another? Is it, I mean, because again, I take it on the traditional reading, which you're trying to resist, is culture is instrumental for producing genius, and genius is the, you know, is the figure that provides that existential solace, that aesthetic justification of existence. So what do you make of the sort of the, those kinds of individual figures in the birth of tragedy?
Well, I mean, I do think Nietzsche has much more hope for the Wagnerian program in the birth of tragedy than, of course, he does later when he turns vehemently against Wagner. So I do think, and he dedicates, as you, as the mention of Wagner suggests, dedicates the book effusively to Wagner, and kind of in the final part of it sees him as the great hope for doing this. So in a way, I think that kind of investment of hope in a genius or a perceived genius is the right story to tell about the birth of tragedy, that Wagner will do this and that he will be the one to reunite or reinvigorate a flagging culture through drawing on this wellspring of myth and presenting it in such a way as to make it suitable for an audience of the time in providing meaning and direction in life, and doing so in this distinctively artistic or aesthetic way. So I think that there is much more hope in the genius as someone able to do that in the birth of tragedy. And you know, I think Nietzsche thought of himself as someone like that at the time when he was writing Thus Spoke Zarathustra. There's the letter where shortly after Wagner's death, where Nietzsche says that he's Wagner's heir to a certain extent. And I think what he had in mind is that he was going to be the one who, Wagner now dead, who was going to be the one who was going to fuse together art, religion, philosophy in this kind of mix that will be able to carry off that task of providing meaning and direction in life, giving us existential solace, giving us certain kinds of myths, and namely the myth of the eternal return, as presented in Zarathustra. So I think he thought of himself for a period as being able to do that, but then I think he becomes doubtful about whether he's, certainly about whether Wagner's able to do it and about whether he's able to do it.
Let me try to ask you about this. I mean, it's just occurring as you were talking, occurs to me in thinking about the birth of tragedy. And I mean, because I find your argument quite compelling. And I mean, one way to sort of root it in the birth of tragedy is to see, you know, the figure of the great individuals as manifest in the Apollinian drive, right? So the Apollinian drive, as Nietzsche develops it in The Birth of Tragedy, is associated originally with the Olympian gods, right? They're the ones who, in the way they're exemplary human beings, and they express the sort of order and structure and excellence of individual striving. Whereas on the other hand, the Dionysian, derived from the Orient, is the expression of community, right? The sort of dissolution, the destruction of the principium individuationis, and the connection of all human beings together and into a general community. And so that's a way in which it seems that Nietzsche synthesizes the individual, the great individual, and the notion of community together in the tragic form of culture. I'm sure what you make of that as a kind of way to think about your project, because you, I mean, you have a way, and you know, you're just talking about, well, so the great individuals are good, but Nietzsche also thinks that culture is good. And one of the things that occurred to me when reading your book is, well, how do those things interrelate? And you have a couple suggestions of the relationship between the two, but one of them might be, I think, more intimate than you suggest, which is this this sort of the interplay, dialectical interrelationship between the Apollinian and Dionysian, which brings together the individual and the community in that way. So what you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, that sounds plausible. I mean, I hadn't thought of it in precisely those terms. One thing I would say is that I find that these categories of the Apollinian and the Dionysian, they're hard to kind of neatly map onto anything. And there's a way in which I can see this parallelism working well, you know, the individual with the Apollinian and the community with the Dionysian. And there are ways in which, you know, we could try to map on art forms or particular types of experience onto these two things. But I think they're very elusive sorts of notions. Because just to give one example relevant to thinking about individual versus community, there's a way in which, though the Dionysian is about certain types of communal experience, it's also destructive of community because there's no kind of order or restraint within it, in a way that the Apollinian could be more productive to creating the kinds of structures that allow for a community to sustain itself. So I find them very tricky tricky sorts of notions in relation both to this idea and to various other ideas in Nietzsche. But I take your general point that there's a lot of complex interrelation between individual and community in both The Birth of Tragedy and in other texts of Nietzsche's. They're kind of not neatly separable things. I bring out in some other parts of the book aspects of that interrelation, but I don't say as much about them in The Birth of Tragedy as I might have.
Yeah, and let's shift over to talking about the Untimely Meditations, which is again another sort of core place in which Nietzsche develops the notion of culture. And maybe you could say a little bit about your take on culture in the Untimely Meditations. There's, of course, this very famous statement in David Strauss about culture as the unity of the style of the expressions of life among a people. I'm of course, as you know, very close to that text. So, why don't you talk for a little while about what your view is? Do you think Nietzsche changes his view from The Birth of Tragedy to Untimely Meditations about culture, or maintains somewhat of continuity?
I think there is some continuity, but there's also beginning to be some change. And I think one of the ways in which there is beginning to be change is that he begins to see culture as something that can realize a kind of excellence for its own sake. And I don't see that idea as much in The Birth of Tragedy. Maybe it's there in certain ways in nascent form and thinking about you know, Attic Greek culture as something of potential excellence that's then ruined by the infusion of Socratism. But I see this idea becoming more explicit only really in the Untimely Meditations. And I think that statement that you cite from the beginning of the Strauss essay, that's a really crucial characterization of this idea of what cultural excellence would be, this unity of artistic style among all the life expressions of a people. And I think that idea it's interestingly continuous in a certain way with The Birth of Tragedy, because it's very artistic or aestheticizing. And The Birth of Tragedy is very much focused on this kind of Teatrum Mundi theme of looking on the world as if it were a work of art. And this is picking up on that idea, but I think changing its focus a bit so that it's less about the kind of existential solace we can get from that, and instead just about the kind of excellence that's realized in that life form.
It does raise the question, I think, as to why, what's the basis of that value if it's not oriented. I guess just to sort of point to my own thoughts about this, I guess I see more continuity in the sense that I think the project of the Untimely Meditations is also about responding to the problem of nihilism and responding to the problem of existential solace, or the need for existential solace. And that, I mean, I suppose one thing that does change between Birth of Tragedy and the Untimely Meditations is that I think Nietzsche begins to appreciate more the importance of exemplary individuals as precisely those expressions of the aesthetic justification of existence. I'm not sure if we want to. You have a later discussion in the book about metaethics and, you know, what the basis of values for Nietzsche are. But I mean, do you have any preliminary thoughts as to why these things automatically become of intrinsic value, I guess, for him?
Yeah, well, I guess, I mean, first on the point of continuity that you note, and I totally agree with that, that he sees the same kind of or he's responding to the same kind of cultural crisis. Mm-hmm. We could characterize it as a crisis of nihilism or use other sorts of terminology, but that kind of crisis that he sees, you know, the Wagnerian program as a potential response to, and mm-hmm. he talks about various other things in connection with the connection with the untimely meditations. I think that you're right, that there is that kind of continuity there. Why he begins to focus on the role of exemplary individuals, I'm not so sure. But I think you're right about that, too, that this is where we really see this come to a particularly crystallized statement, and you see this focus in Nietzsche from the untimely meditations onward, that there's this role for exemplary great individuals. And I don't really know why his thought goes in this direction in a way that can seem like it's quite sudden, actually. You know, just a year apart from the first essay of the Untimely Meditations and the Birth of Tragedy.
Yeah, and so let's talk about another one of your features. Your discussion about the Untimely Meditations focuses on the famous discussions in Schopenhauer's Educator about mm-hmm. the relationship between these exemplars and the community around them, and particularly, I guess, what has become infamous discussions about how, well, so the mass of human beings gains the value of their life mm-hmm. in virtue of being of service or being tools for the mm-hmm. for the exemplary individuals. And mm-hmm. so you have a whole chapter on this. And maybe we could shift to that more generally, sure, yeah. which is the discussion about Nietzsche and slavery, broadly understood. Also mm-hmm. appears in another early essay of Nietzsche's on the Greek state, where Nietzsche talks mm-hmm. about the essential importance, necessity, and desirability of slavery to maintain culture. And you level an argument which I find completely persuasive. I think is absolutely right, that Nietzsche is not advocating what I call in my own work a predatory understanding of the exemplar towards slavery, but again, what I call more of a noblesse oblige type of approach, mm-hmm. which is a view of aristocratic governance over individuals that benefits them, right? It's not mm-hmm. the position is not a predatory exploitation of slaves, but the idea in Nietzsche is for the exemplars to benefit, to make their lives worth living. That doesn't mean that Nietzsche's position is right. There may be mm-hmm. other problems with it, but it can't simply be this sort of predatory approach. So maybe you could take that up and, you know, talk about Schopenhauer's Educator, Greek state, or wherever you want to take it.
Yeah. Well, I guess I see myself as, again, mediating between kind of interpretive extremes with respect to that crucial passage in Schopenhauer's Educator about the exemplars and their relation to the rest of humankind. So, you know, at one extreme, we have the kind of Emersonian perfectionist readings mm-hmm. that try to downplay some of these seemingly more unsavory aspects of Nietzsche's view. And then at another extreme, we have the kinds of perfectionist readings that, for example, Thomas Hercke has put forward, mm-hmm. where it looks like the locus of excellence is really just in those few great individuals, and no one else really matters except insofar as they could be some kind of help or hindrance to the flourishing of those few great individuals. And I see both of these extremes as kind of missing the point. And I agree with the line you're pressing, that the relationship is often one more of noblesse oblige than of exploitation or something predatory at least as outlined in Schopenhauer's Educator, the idea seems to be that the idea of Nietzsche seems to be that the great individual will awaken something in the people who are not great individuals that makes them want to be in the service of the great individual. Mm-hmm. And it's not about kind of awakening them to their own self-cultivation, which is, I think, the mistake of the Emersonian perfectionist reading, but it's awakening them to be in the service of either that great individual or some collective project. And I think Nietzsche thinks that's very hard to stomach. Awakening you to your own self-cultivation, that's a much easier thing to stomach. That sits nicely with our kinds of liberal ideas. But awakening you to the service of a collective project, or even more extremely, to the service of another person, which is, I think, the really difficult idea Nietzsche is pressing in section 6 of the Untimely Meditations and the few sections after that, that's much harder to stomach. But I think that is the view that he's pressing there, and I think he thinks that you have, if you're not one of those great individuals, you have your highest calling and your highest flourishing in fulfilling that sort of a role. Mm-hmm. So I see that as, and I see that as continuous with the view that he's putting forward in the Greek state as well, where he emphasizes the way in which being used as a tool of genius redounds to the dignity of the of the slave. So it's not just that the slave is being exploited and then kind of being cast aside with no receiving no benefit. The claim is the much more extreme one, that the slave has highest dignity being in the service of a great individual, or I would add to a kind of collective enterprise that's spearheaded by a great individual. Now, you know, as you say, whether that's the right view or not to take, putting Nietzsche aside, another question entirely. But I think that this is the challenging idea that Nietzsche's pressing upon us.
Yeah, and I mean, maybe just to add to that a little bit, I wonder what you make of this, because I think this is one of the uses of reading the sort of existential project alongside or behind this view in the Untimely Meditations. That is that I think give a little bit more force to Nietzsche's argument here. That is that, you know, if Nietzsche thinks that life, mere existence is not worth living alone, that the mass of human beings live lives of quiet desperation, they need some kind of justification for their existence, right? And so, so there's a sort of deep motivation that's at work there, and the main alternative for him is a kind of, you know, it's a form of either utilitarianism or socialism, that the sort of universal dignity of human beings, and that is not going to solve the question, because simply sort of trying to benefit other human beings whose lives are equally not worth living is not going to all of a sudden make your life worth living. So it's only through the justification of existence through these exemplars that you know. So I don't know if that's helpful in your mind and thinking, or at work at all in thinking about how to motivate Nietzsche's thought, because otherwise it just looks like, you know, mere sort of fetishism for human exemplars here. There has to be some, I think, other motivation for it.
Yeah, no, I think that there. I think that that is a nice way of connecting the points. I think that he is looking to the kind of ennoblement that is possible through being in the service of this enterprise, and thinking that through that kind of ennoblement we raise ourselves above just, you know, mere centers of pleasure. And raise ourselves above the lower animals.
We're
consecrated. He uses the language of consecration,
right.
Consecrating ourselves to culture in this way by engaging often in sacrifices, but in things that are very difficult. You know, we have to work hard at this. And I think he thinks there is a kind of ennoblement that comes through that in a way that makes lives worth living, that would not otherwise really be worth living at all, that would just be about accumulating one pleasure after another, which I think he thinks makes us, you know, essentially like cows, the image that he'll often use.
Right. Right. Yeah.
And I think a crucial point, though, point to question, is whether he thinks this story will be satisfying for people about, you know, this is the way that you can raise yourself up and ennoble yourself, whether people will actually find this palatable. And I think that you see some optimism in mm-hmm. Schopenhauer as educator, that he thinks people could actually be persuaded by this and want to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he comes to give up that optimism later, but he still holds out hope in a kind of idealistic way for that people might be but won around to this idea, perhaps by the great individual, or perhaps by the way the great individual awakens a certain sort of feeling of calling in them.
Yeah.
And it becomes pretty doubtful about that later, that people would want to be or be willing to do this. But I think he retains the idea, though, that people could be ennobled kind of without really caring about it, which I think is a striking and in some ways disturbing idea, but it's one of Nietzsche's most provocative ideas, that you know your life could be ennobled by something that you do, even if you don't really care about that very much, and you don't take a kind of existential sustenance or satisfaction from it. But I think that's a powerful and interesting idea.
Yeah, I'd be interested in sort of fleshing out that last part of what you just said, because, well, so it is quite interesting that Nietzsche uses these terms Tierheit and Menschheit, this sort of animality and humanity in the Untimely Meditations, which I think puts him squarely within the Kantian tradition, since Kant himself uses these terms about human beings being sort of a torn between our animal instincts and needing a kind of ennoblement up to our humanity. And our humanity sort of speaks to our conscience for Kant, as it does for Nietzsche and Schopenhauer's educator. It calls us up to a sort of higher calling. So maybe say a little bit more about what your sort of last point there, that is just the disturbing aspect of Nietzsche. I mean, one of the ways you think about this is that, well, this is, you know, it's a little bit like what Kant talks about, which is the way in which we can find a kind of existential solace in contributing even a little bit to the moral progress of human community. You know, that's what I find very, very convincing about your book, is that this, you know, the emphasis on community is really important in Nietzsche. I totally agree with that. And that's, you know, I think that's what gives a little bit more force behind Nietzsche's argument that most human beings contribute to a certain kind of community. Right, to a certain kind of culture. Maybe you just, so say a little bit more about that. Yeah.
Well, actually, first a thought on the animality humanity issue that's in the background here, as I think one of the complexities here is that though Nietzsche celebrates in the Untimely Meditations ways that we can raise ourselves above our animality, he's someone who also sees fundamentally more continuity between these things than I think Kant does. So in a way, I think he's part of a Kantian perfectionist tradition in thinking that we have something special or distinctive that we're able to do that raises us above mere animality. But at the same time, I think he's someone who wants to see more continuity there than Kant would be willing to see, that it's a kind of much starker sort of divide between, you know, our nature as rational beings and our nature as, you know, mere pathological beings, or whatever, you know, whatever it may be, framed in starker Kantian terms. So I think Nietzsche's part of the Kantian tradition, but also importantly different from it. You know, as you see very explicitly in Beyond Good and Evil, we're talking about the resistance to the metaphysical bird catchers, I think is his phrase, or, you know, piping to us that we're something higher. So I think that's a complicated issue in Nietzsche. But on the issue of existential solace, I hadn't thought about that in connection with Kantian ideas of community. And I think that there is a commonality there that I hadn't really appreciated. But I think that it's the most disturbing point, which I was gesturing at previously, was that somehow what we do, viewed objectively or viewed from the third personal perspective, could come apart from how we see things and how we appreciate things.
Hmm.
And I don't know enough about the Kantian view on community to know what he thinks on that issue, whether he has a stance on that particular issue.
So I think just clarify a little bit. Why do you say that it's when we contribute to culture, it's different than how we assess the situation? Maybe say a little. I mean, because I guess as I understand the consecration to culture, the idea is that we think of our own life as in some sense, you know, devoted to this higher ideal. But are you mm-hmm. saying that it's divergent from how we think about our?
I think yes, potentially. So,
if we don't give ourselves the culture,
potentially divergent.
Yeah. Okay.
But potentially divergent, because I think Nietzsche's holding out hope, as I was saying in the Untimely Meditations, that the two could converge: the way you see your life and the way the way it's actually being ennobled. But a way in which I think they could come apart, stark way in which I think they could come apart, is someone who sees what he's doing as, for instance, to the glory of God.
Mm-hmm.
But what he's doing is instead to the glory of something much more mundane. It's to the glory of human culture or to the glory of a great individual. But this person sees his life through an entirely theological lens and thinks, you know, what I'm doing in building this great cathedral and carrying out the vision of Brunelleschi is I'm honoring God. And, you know, that's what gives my life meaning. And I think Nietzsche would think, well, that's a mistake. I mean, it's not that you're honoring God that gives your life meaning, but maybe you are, in fact, doing something that gives your life meaning, but you just don't realize quite why.
I see.
And that's the kind of case where I see them as coming apart very starkly.
Right. Yeah, the religious example is a little bit more difficult. I mean, in the Untimely Meditations, the examples Nietzsche tends to use more are, think of those individuals who give their lives to the state, right?
Yes.
Or to money-making, right?
Yeah.
The merchants who just spend their counting their coins all day long.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, they think that, like, the glory of the state is my highest calling. And Nietzsche's point, as expressed there, as you, that doesn't express your fundamental freedom and uniqueness, the sort of miracle that is the distinctive character of you. You're giving yourself over to this homogenous machine state.
But I actually think in some of those cases, too, they could fit the same basic pattern as the religious example. So you could have someone, you know, completely devoted to the cause of the Prussian state or whatever it may be. And this means that the person is, you know, devoting tremendous energy and effort to some kind of cultural endeavor.
Right.
And of course, the relation between state and culture are very complicated in Nietzsche. But suppose that the person just conceives of it in terms of, I'm doing what's good for the Prussian state by promoting, this particular cultural endeavor. I think the person could be totally mistaken about, what really makes it valuable or meaningful. It was really valuable or meaningful, not because it's in the service of the Prussian state, but because it's in the service of culture. But, you know, the person could have that mistaken self-understanding of things, but still be doing something that's ennobling them. Mm-hmm. They're just misunderstanding why it's ennobling.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that could have the same kind of structure.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the one with the more commercial examples, perhaps harder to fit into the mold, but maybe with some ingenuity, we could come up with some cases like that. But I think that the basic pattern is where you have some conceptualization of how your life is being ennobled, but that it involves a central kind of mistake. But nonetheless, what you're doing is actually ennobling your life, even if you don't understand why.
And isn't the same thing at work? I mean, just to jump to the genealogy of morals, too. I mean, you have this interesting chapter on the genealogy of morals and Nietzsche's assessment of Christianity. I'm just thinking a similar move is at work in Nietzsche there, which is to say, you know, when most people think about Nietzsche and Christianity, they emphasize the way in which he talks about how, like, diseased and anti-life Christianity is. But as you point out quite rightly, there's a way in which Christianity actually, you know, deepens the human soul, makes possible the sort of cultural forms of excellence that he celebrates in modernity. So there seems to be a kind of cunning cunning of reason, kind mm-hmm. of move that, you know, yeah. from a kind of Kantian or Hegelian way of thinking mm-hmm. of these things, that it sort of operates behind the back of Christian agents, that mm-hmm. it brings about the eventual sort of, you know, sort of dialectical development of more forms of genuine forms of cultural excellence, even if that's not what they intend. They intend building this cathedral for the glory of God, but, you know, it's ultimately for a different cultural purpose.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that that's a pervasive theme in the genealogy, that there is, I think the cunning of reason is a nice phrase for it here, that Christianity is able to bring about these kinds of meritorious cultural goods, and this means that Nietzsche has a fundamental ambivalence to it,
yeah.
as he does to so many things. So he's, you know, in a way, vehemently opposed to some of its animating ideas and doctrines, but when it comes to the effects it's had, is much more ambivalent about them. Thinking, yeah, it's, you know, had very destructive effects in certain ways, in the way that it's, you know, turned people against their drives, and had all kinds of related sorts of problematic psychological effects. But at the same time, through that very mechanism and through other mechanisms, it's, as you say, made people deeper and more interesting, and enabled these kinds of sophisticated cultural endeavors. And so I think ambivalence is the right sort of word to describe Nietzsche's attitude toward a phenomenon like this. And it's one of the reasons, in fact, that I try to separate the question of what something's effects have been
right.
and the question of what kinds of ideas are embedded or enshrined in the thing. I think actually Nietzsche has some ambivalence at both levels, but I think it's useful to separate the two to kind of keep in mind what issues are in play.
Yeah, maybe you could just sketch that out, the sort of causal versus expressive ways of thinking about cultural assessment. Maybe you could just, because I found that helpful, yeah.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, what I have is, what I have in mind is a distinction between assessing a cultural formation in terms of what it causes, what it, you know, what effects it has downstream and what influence it has, on the one hand, as opposed to thinking about what ideas are enshrined or embedded in that particular cultural formation itself and what we make of those ideas themselves. And I try to distinguish those two kinds of criticisms. I think it's important for understanding Nietzsche's critique, but also just an important lesson about cultural criticism generally, that there are these two models by which, at least two models by which it can operate. And I try to bring out through playing up this more expressive model, the model where we look to ideas or to values that are enshrined in a cultural formation, to try to bring out this alternative kind of cultural criticism that I think is in evidence in, for example, the first generation of the Frankfurt School, where I think there was some profound influence from Nietzsche's model of cultural criticism onto the model of cultural criticism that they were employing, and also a profound profound sensitivity to aesthetic models for thinking about these things.
Mm-hmm.
So where the model is one that is hermeneutic, in essence. What we're doing is we're looking to a particular cultural formation and seeing it as something that's in need of interpretation. Kind of what do we see when we try to read it, as it were, read it, particularly to read it against the grain? What's, you know, embedded in it? What can we make of it? And this alternative model where we're just looking to the effects of something, you know, this is the kind of thing that could, in essence, just be, farmed out to the empirical sociologists. It's a less, as I see it, distinctively philosophical enterprise. It's just asking us for asking one to make an empirical claim about what something's effects are. Whereas this other enterprise I see is more distinctively philosophical and more critical, because it involves this dimension of interpretation and then criticism of those ideals and values that are enshrouded or embedded or enshrined in something.
I'll ask you about the sort of expressive or hermeneutic approach in a second, but on the causal approach, of course, one of the main ways in which Nietzsche talks about the causal effects of good and bad cultures is the way in which they produce or don't produce exemplary individuals, right? Mm-hmm. So in that way, there's a sort of there's a connection back to a philosophical assessment, right? That it's the end point or the ultimate end effect, even if it's a sort of sociological account broadly understood, there's a sort of connection back as its end point to some sort of highest form of human.
I think that's right. Yeah, there's going to be, even with that model of critique, looking back to what values you ultimately care about realizing. So if the value is having exemplary great individuals or something more collective, having a great culture, then you're going to want to think about the interconnections between what the effects are and that thing. And I think you're right that that is a more distinctively philosophical enterprise. Back to the ambivalence thing, though, I think Nietzsche's line is basically one of ambivalence. When it comes to the effects that Christian culture, or broadly speaking, moral culture has had on the realization of exemplary individuals, I think he thinks it's just been mixed. It's not particularly deleterious. It's not particularly good. We see some ways in which it's been deleterious. It's been good. But I think that the... in terms of its effects, we don't have kind of clearly the chips falling one way or another.
Yeah, and on the expressive approach to culture, which I found quite interesting, maybe say a little bit about how you think about how Nietzsche assesses cultures there. I mean, you use good examples that it hadn't sort of occurred to me in thinking about this in the context. Like when Nietzsche talks about Rome, for example, like he'll praise Rome in the later works, like in Twilight of the Idols. And it's not like Rome is good because of its effects in producing great individuals. There weren't many great individuals in Rome, like on Nietzsche's view. But it's something, you know, that Rome, I thought that was a perfect example. On Nietzsche's view, it's something like the totality itself expresses a form of excellence. So is that it? Is it like the human excellence that it embodies, or is it the sort of formal aesthetic character of a sort of unity amidst manifoldness, or how do you think about that sort of the criteria for expressive cultural excellence there?
Well, I think it's both of those things, both the more formal side and, if you will, the more content side. So it's both about these formal characteristics, such as unity, for instance, unity of style in the life expressions of the people, with that idea, I think, carrying through to some of the later works, such as Twilight, where he and Antichrist, where he talks about Rome. But I think it's not just formal, because he also cares about the kinds of ideals that are being realized in these cultures, ideals that are the broadly Nietzschean ideals, things like nobility, strength, excellence, power, creative striving, accomplishment, what have you. And I think that he sees those sorts of ideals being realized in collective forms of life and not just in individual lives. And Rome is one of the examples where this is true. Those kinds of ideas are realized in the life form of ancient Rome. And it also has formal characteristics that he celebrates, and he compares it in various places to a work of art, a work of art in the grand style. But I think he's thinking about it not just in formal terms. And of course, when we think back to the analogy to the work of art, Nietzsche is not someone who's going to want to assess works of art just in formal terms either. He's someone who thinks, they have formal properties that we'll celebrate, but also he's someone concerned with what kinds of ideas are being celebrated or presented in the work of art. You know, if you're propounding life negation or what have you, as he complains about Wagner's Parsifal, that's a mark against your work, even if it has various kinds of formal excellences. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, the same kind of model applies when he's thinking about forms of life understood on the work of art model too.
We started talking a little bit about Nietzsche's late period. Maybe you could maybe just take a little bit of time and say more about if there's any other kind of textual evidence that you want to bring out to support your how you support your overall claim. Like for mm-hmm. example, I particularly liked your discussion of Beyond Good and Evil. Is it 257, 258, where he's talking mm-hmm. about aristocratic societies and how they provide the meaning for justification for human existence. But anyway, you want to sort of, you know, bring out, hey, yeah, in the later period works, there really is still this commitment to the intrinsic value of culture.
Yeah, so I think we see that in those crucial passages in Beyond Good and Evil. I think the place we see it most starkly is in the final works of 1888, particularly in The Antichrist and Twilight of the Idols. So in both of these works, he is drawing on these ideas of cultural totalities realizing collective forms of excellence, where it doesn't just seem to be about promoting great individuals, but realizing a kind of excellence in their way of life as a whole. And Rome is one of his examples in, I think, in both of those texts. He talks about the Moorish culture of Spain as well. He talks about the Renaissance in those texts. And I think those are examples where he's thinking about, those are examples that he thinks of as particularly telling, where we have this realization of cultural excellence that's taking this more collective kind of form. I think another thing we see in the late period is the echoing of these ideas about slavery. Certainly in those passages that even if the terminology of slavery is not always used, in some of the passages the idea of slavery is basically there, and in others the terminology of slavery is used. So we have those passages from Beyond Good and Evil talking about the hierarchical structure and the pathos of distance and a number of related ideas. And then in the Antichrist, for instance, we have Nietzsche in essence citing Aristotle. He doesn't cite Aristotle by, you know, text quotation and passage reference, but using the exact same language as Aristotle in the Politics in talking about slavery and how it can be in the best interest of the slave. And I think that Nietzsche just straightforwardly draws on that idea from Aristotle, and indeed an idea in Plato's Republic as well, in the Antichrist in several different places.
You don't talk about this in your book, but since it's the Political Theory Review, I didn't know if you had any thoughts about the political side or nature of culture. I mean, one way to ask this question is, well, how are cultures, good cultures fostered and bad cultures restricted? Is it through some active political view? I mean, one extreme of the literature is to say that, yes, politics is actively involved in shaping culture. Another side of the literature, which I'm sort of more on the side of, is culture and politics should really be fairly separable. I have somewhat of a minority view in thinking Nietzsche was somewhat of a liberal thinker in this way. But what's your thought, any thoughts about the sort of political side of culture?
Yeah, well, I guess I'm more in the direction of your view in thinking that Nietzsche's seeing culture and the state as separate sorts of things, and seeing the state as not a particularly good instrument for the advancement of cultural ends. So, indeed, very concerned about what happens when the state tries to get its interfering tentacles into cultural endeavors. So I think he just doesn't have a I think he doesn't have a vision about what kind of straightforward political implications the view will have, except a kind of skepticism about the role that the nation states of his time could play in furthering these cultural endeavors. And I think he thinks they're going to be very bad instruments for trying to bring it about for various reasons. I think an issue that's in the background here is, you know, exactly what we mean by politics and political in connection with Nietzsche. I think it's always good to try to render that question a bit more precise. So I like it, you know, expressing it in the way that we just have about what role the state in the period that Nietzsche's writing will, on his view, play in this. Not much. And so I think, you know, talking about Nietzsche's politics or political theory in the abstract can be difficult unless we're kind of more precise about exactly what sense we mean that. Because in a very broad sense of politics, Nietzsche is thinking about the polis. His thinking is political in that way, but he doesn't have a view about what I think a view about. What the ideal form of a contemporary nation state should be. So in that way, I disagree with some of the aristocratic readers of Nietzsche who see it as a political theory or a kind of way that the state should be organized. I think, you know, Nietzsche's just doesn't really have a view on that question. It could be that broadly speaking, liberal democratic societies are the best way to realize this cultural vision. At least in terms of political structure. It could be that there are various other ways that hierarchy and aristocracy needs to come in different ways or forms. I don't think he's, as it were, weighing in on this narrower question of what form a political organization a society should take.
Couldn't agree more, and thank you for that view. We're aligned here, so this is good. Yeah, I mean, I also couldn't agree more on your view that we need to be more precise. We Nietzsche scholars need to be more precise in what we mean by politics when we talk about it, because there's a way in which we're sort of influenced by the way Nietzsche talks, because of course Nietzsche will say things like, in Beyond Good and Evil, philosophers are the legislators for the whither and the for what of man.
And politics and these kinds of things.
Right. And of course, you know, generations of readers have said, aha, there, it means that we should have philosopher kings because they should be legislators. And I think that's completely wrong. I mean, I don't think that Nietzsche actually literally means politics in the sense of the modern nation state there, that philosophers should have roles in the modern nation state. Instead, I think, again, given my somewhat idiosyncratic Nietzschean reading, I think it has to do with a form of cultural legislation, that is a form of law giving to a way of thinking about cultural value rather than political value. So I agree. We need, and whenever Nietzsche talks about the modern nation state, he's almost categorically condemning it.
I agree with that. And I think these images of legislation are very difficult because our most natural interpretation of them is as, you know, someone who's kind of laying down positive law, you know, on a tablet or whatever it may be. And I think the idea of legislation is very different. It's elusive, whatever it is. But I think it's something very different in Nietzsche when he's thinking about the role of the philosopher as a kind of legislator. I think it's, you know, more connected with changing our values in certain ways at the cultural level, or maybe just in some small subset of the culture, changing our values, and not about any kind of legislation of positive law or giving a rule for all.
So let's finish by talking a little bit about the meta-ethical issues surrounding community and individual in Nietzsche. You have one of your final chapters is on the sort of basis of Nietzsche's values. You could lay out a little bit. A lot of the chapter is critical of some of the existing scholarship or some of the existing alternatives on this. Say, yeah, like Leiter's more skeptical view and mm-hmm. even forms of perspectivism associated with somebody like Bernard Regenster. Mm-hmm. So maybe you just say, you know, I mean, what's the criticism of the more skeptical anti-realist views of value? And then the mm-hmm. what's the problem with some of the more perspectivist, subjectivist, perspectivist approach to value in Nietzsche?
Yeah, well, I think the focus of this chapter is kind of really getting into the textual nitty-gritty and looking at some of the passages that have been cited in support of these views. And I think the textual evidence, when we look at it closely, is actually much more indeterminate and doesn't really clearly support one of these metaethical positions or another. And it's part of the reason why we've seen just about every single possible metaethical position one might hold attributed to Nietzsche. The texts are not particularly clear on this, and I think it's probably because it was an issue that he wasn't very interested in. His thoughts were really elsewhere. This is a kind of philosopher's issue. And one of the ways that I think it's been made to seem like it's an issue that Nietzsche cares about is that he's constantly talking about, you know, the creation of values and the value of our values and things like this. But I think the mistake is to think that he's taking up a kind of abstract metaethical question when he's concerned with that. I think what he's concerned with is instead basically a sociological question. He wants to talk about, you know, where our values, understood as kind of sociological or anthropological entities, where those sorts of things came from. Mm. He's not interested, I think, in this more abstract question of the nature of value as such, where we understand value in that way as a metaethicist might. He is interested in the nature of values, those social or anthropological entities, and telling us they're not the kinds of things that came from God or that are written in the fabric of the universe. They're things that are created at particular times in history, or that emerge, might be a better image, at particular times in history, and wants to remind us of that contingency and the power relations that are present in the emergence of these values. But on this more abstract question about the nature of value as such, I think Nietzsche just doesn't clearly take a stand on this. There are a few passages where it seems like he might, but it's actually not clear to me whether he's talking about that abstract metaethical question or he's talking about values understood as these social or anthropological entities. And I think there's been a tendency in Anglophone Nietzsche scholarship to think we have to have Nietzsche talking about this metaethical question that we really care about, but I just don't think he does say much about it. And most of what people find in Nietzsche is just their own view anyway, that they hold outside of Nietzsche. So it's just saying, you know, Nietzsche held this view too, and I think, well, you know, what's the point of that?
Yeah, I certainly agree with the ways in which there's been an anachronistic importation of certain isms back onto Nietzsche in this debate, sort of anti-realist versus realist approaches. I mean, but there is a way in which, as you say, whether or not Nietzsche is engaged in the nitty-gritty of some of these metaethical issues, it is clear that Nietzsche, well, you argue, I say that, and I agree with you, that he can't be a kind of subjectivist or skeptic about value, because he does want to make certain kind of, just call it objective normative claims about mm-hmm. human excellence, sort of this aesthetic and otherwise ethical forms of excellence that we've been talking about all along. And those can't simply be merely subjective preferences, because then Nietzsche wouldn't have any basis on which to evaluate other mm-hmm. forms of life. I don't know if there's anything else you want to add to that. I mean, of course, raises the question then, well, so like if Nietzsche feels able to question the veracity mm-hmm. of other values, then why can't we ask about the value of his values? And I think that's in part where the metaethical issues come up, is because mm-hmm. Nietzsche is so attuned to the genesis and development of value that the question immediately is raised, well, what about the genesis and development of Nietzsche's own values?
Yeah, and I agree with you that that question certainly comes up. and presents itself when we start to think about these issues. I guess my own view on it is slightly different from the view that than the view that you were expressing, because I think that it's not that Nietzsche thinks he's clearly entitled to make these kinds of objective claims. Hmm. I think he doesn't really consider the issue. So it's not, my view is not that he's thinking that he's entitled to make the objective claims, but that it's just kind of not clear what he thinks about it. He makes pronouncements, certainly, but mm-hmm. whether he thinks these are reflective of some kind of deep truth about value, or whether he thinks maybe they're a more local kind of preference that could potentially be undermined by the sort of challenge you were suggesting, I'm not sure. Hmm. And I think that, Nietzsche's response to that challenge might in fact be, I don't know that these are the, beyond all doubt, that these are the right values. So I'm more hesitant on this issue than some others might be, because it can look like my chapter is a kind of defense of a realist reading of Nietzsche, but it's not meant to be. What it's meant to be is a criticism of really all the views that think that Nietzsche has an important stake in these kinds of issues. And I think the most interesting questions in Nietzsche are elsewhere, and not on these kinds of metaethical issues that have gotten a lot of scholarly energy expended on them.
Mm-hmm. Are you continuing to work on Nietzsche moving forward, or what's the next project?
I have a few paper-length things that are in progress that are on aspects of Nietzsche or inspired by Nietzsche in certain ways. I have a piece on Ressentiment that's thinking about the concept, taking inspiration from Nietzsche, but really just kind of trying to work out what the moral psychology is independently of some of Nietzsche's commitments. So that piece, but my next big project is mostly not about Nietzsche. It has a little bit of Nietzsche in it, but it's about the idea of art having the ambition to take over for religion in the 19th century and in early modernism, and looking at some variations on that theme, and looking at the deeper conceptual question of kind of what it would be to do that, that I think has been really under theorized certainly in the Anglophone literature on this, but just under theorized generally, because people have told histories of aesthetics where they've talked about this idea, but I think haven't really focused on the range of ways in which art tries to take over for religion. So what I do in this next book project is to look at some variations on this big theme. There are a lot of different figures you could draw upon, but I try to focus on a few of them and try to look at a few functions that religion performs, and see how art might try to take up those functions as well, even if it can't succeed.
Oh, yeah. Well, that sounds great. I have to have you back on when you finish that project.
Great.
Thank you so much for this conversation, Andrew. Welcome, and thanks again for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Sure. Thank you for the great questions and for reading the book so carefully. It's a pleasure to chat about it.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. And thanks to you for listening.